Okay, let's start. Okay. Good afternoon. I'm back, as you can see. First of all, apologies for last week. I'm not sure how many people saw my email in time. I sent it to your official email address. Maybe that also is another good reason to read your email regularly if you haven't done so yet. But I hope not too many people had to be here. I didn't like doing this, but there was no other way. I also hope that you've been able to access the lecture from last year, which I put on. As I said, I had wanted to make some changes, but not major changes. So it should be pretty much compatible, and it actually fit in quite nicely with what we had done before. And I can basically continue from that today. Just a few, really very, very few announcements. First of all, the first assignment, you're waiting for that, I'm aware of that. It's been marked, I've finished it. I haven't transferred all the points and everything into a Excel sheet. I will create this early next week. It'll be uploaded before Christmas, before the Christmas break. What I'll do is that it'll have your matricul number and then how many points you got. And if you're wondering about whether you can fail because of that, no, you can't. But you should please take the points that you have got in this as an indication of whether you need to look at the library again or whether everything is doing fine, is going fine. So I'll also put put the correct answers that I was hoping to get online as well with that. So you should be able to look at that sometime next week. Okay. Also, this is just a minor comment about last week's lecture, or rather last year's lecture. Some of you may have noticed the rather odd title that I had, which said something like English Language 130 or whatever. This was because last year I reused the title sheet of a lecture which I had given sometime earlier in my old job in Lancaster and failed to change it. That's the danger of copy-paste. And of course I wasn't able to change that because I simply used the recording from last year. But it was the correct lecture. Good. Yes, there's a question. StudIP, yes. It'll be a PDF file with a long list of numbers ordered by number, and then yes. Otherwise, I can also. If you have any other suggestion, I could. No, I'll do that. Yes, I could order it by points. That would be yes. Good. Yes. Just something about the points. Basically, you got 1 point for each answer, and I've been relatively nasty in terms of, if you misspelled an author's name, like if I asked who was the author of this and that article and you managed to misspell it, then you don't get the point for it, okay, because I felt you probably looked at it but misspelled it. So it's graded in a fairly nasty way, so just wanted to warn you. Good, but let's get on with linguistics. What did we do? What did we do in the last lecture? We looked at different types of clauses. We had a look at main versus subordinate clauses. I also introduced this concept of matrix clause, if I remember correctly. Then I looked at different types of clauses, meaning that there are simple clauses, complex, where there is an element of hierarchy, and compound clauses, where two equal clauses are combined usually with the conjunction and or something similar. Okay. Then I introduced the concept of participants and adjuncts. So items that are required by the verb, which are participate in the full meaning of the verb, versus adjuncts, which are elements which are not obligatory. I also made a point about form and function, as I've done, as I did, I think, already in the second in the lecture before that, and I looked at a number of different clause types. So this was really quite a lot of material. Okay. Now, I'm going to revise some of those, but actually I'm going to add a little bit more material today, of course, because it's a new lecture. Okay. But I hope that I can come back to a number of those points to revise them as well. Good. One point which came up was, well, it had to do with clauses and subjects. Okay, that was already seen, I think, in the first syntax lecture, that we can have a clause functioning as a subject. Okay. But anyway, I have a few points to make here. First of all, if you want to count, and this is a repetition from last time, if you want to count the number of clauses, then you count the number of full lexical verbs, okay, or the verb groups, as we will call them today. If you have two different lexical verbs, then you will have two clauses. That's pretty straightforward. I also showed you that clauses can contain subjects, okay, in a way, because, well, lower down in the hierarchy. Or that usually all clauses have a subject, with an exception, namely if they are in the dependent clause, or if they are a dependent clause, if we're talking about a dependent clause, then we might actually have a clause without a subject. And I'm showing you another one like that today. And I asked you to prepare this sentence, draw a tree, or at least look at the syntactic structure of this sentence. And I would like to do this now with you. I would like to give you the answer to this task, and I would like to repeat what I've said about clauses and subjects and verbs, etc. How many verbs do you have here in this sentence? That's very easy. Regrets and hitting. Okay, they're next to each other, but they're two different full lexical verbs. So we've got two verbs, therefore we must have two clauses. Now, what are the subjects here? Now, it's no problem about Ray being the subject of the main clause, but what is the subject of the subordinate clause? That's basically the question that came up at the end of last lecture, too. Let's just rephrase this. Ray regrets that he hit the old man with a stick. Okay. And then we have no problem to see that the subordinate clause, that he hit the old man with a stick, has a subject too, namely he. Okay. And he is actually the same person, we presume, because otherwise Ray wouldn't regret it, as Ray. So Ray and he refer to the same entity. Okay. You could probably come up with a situation where Ray and he are not the same person, but let's leave that. Okay. So let's look at the tree. Okay. I don't know how many of you tried to draw the tree, but here is what it could have looked like. As always, we would start with the verb with the word classes. So we've got noun, Ray, regret, verbs, verb, another noun, pronoun, therefore a noun, he, etc., etc. I still haven't really given this one here a name. I may have given it a name last lecture, but let's leave it at that at the moment. Let's just leave it empty. Now, Ray is a single word noun phrase. Okay. And then we have a verb phrase, and together with this, it forms a sentence. Okay. So this is the subject, and then the predicate, which follows, which is realized in the form of a verb phrase, as predicates are. But the predicate contains another clause, a subordinate clause. So we have another subject realized as a noun phrase, he, and we have another verb phrase. We must have two verb phrases because we have two clauses and two full verbs. Hit somebody, okay. Hit is a verb that requires not someone, well, not just a hitter, but also a hittee, okay, someone who is being hit, and that is the old man, which is a noun phrase with an adjective phrase pre-modifying the noun, man. Okay. So this adjective phrase here is an optional element. You could remove it and it would still be a noun phrase that's left, but you can add it if you want to modify or if you want to say something about what kind of man it is. Then what is with the stick? With the stick is a preposition phrase which contains a preposition, namely the head of the phrase, and then a noun phrase here, which is the complement of the preposition. It is required, and it has the form of a determiner and a noun. Now, how does this all hang together? Well, we see here that we have another S. In a way, we have an S within an S. Okay, so we have a clause within another higher clause, or the subordinate clause in the main clause. And both of them are given the label S. Okay. How is it? Does it hang together? Well, we've got this complementizer. That's why I call it here. It's actually a conjunction. It joins the two clauses, but it joins it differently from in a coordinated clause because it's a different conjunction. Okay. Now, how can we prove that this is the correct structure? Okay. Last time I introduced you to a number of tests, movement tests, etc., replacement tests. Just quickly some replacement here. It is very easy to replace, to replace a large chunk here with a simple noun phrase, and we have the same structure as before, but just a lot of the elements that we needed, which are more complex down in the subordinate clause, are now gone, but we have in the same place as before a constituent, namely in this case now, just a noun phrase. Okay. In fact, we could make it even more simple. We could just replace it with a single word noun phrase, it. Okay. And this, on one level of the hierarchy, is exactly the same as this here. It's just lower down where more complexity comes from or is found. But really lower down, it isn't all that complex either, because if you look at it in separation here, then this is a straightforward sentence with a noun phrase and a verb phrase. It's just that it is subsumed hierarchically, or that it that is contained in a hierarchically higher sentence. Again, we could replace certain elements here. Can we replace with the stick? Well, we change the meaning, of course, but we could, for example, replace it with an adverb phrase, viciously. And again, we would replace everything that's under a single node, we would replace a constituent. Let's put it back there, but of course we can also say with it, and what we replace then is just the complement to the preposition, so it's no longer the stick, but it is now just it. Okay. So lots of elements in a sentence can be replaced, and what you can replace in one go is usually a constituent. Okay, last one, hit him with a stick, same thing. Okay. Right, now, what do we have here? We have here an old man with a stick. Okay. It's the best picture I found. I don't know. There must be others, but that's what a Google search returned. Okay. Now, can you have a look at this? And can you tell me whether anything is wrong here? Not with the man, okay, but with a tree. Yes?
It could either mean that the old man was holding the stick.
Okay.
Or hitting all that rain, hit the old man using the stick.
Okay, can you tell?
No.
Well, no, you can't tell from the sentence as such, but can you tell on the basis of my tree?
I think rain regrets is made, I don't know, the most important part of the sentence indicates that it regrets the action of hitting the man. Wait, no, that's...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, we...
So then again, we have two options.
We have two options, yes, but...
Yeah.
Or let's read, yeah, okay. Yes, okay. The question is this branch in the correct position? Is it off the correct correct node? Is it coming off the correct node? In fact, if we do this, okay, if we add the preposition phrase onto, or if we have it dominated by the noun phrase node, then we say, well, we describe a situation where there is Ray hitting a man that was holding a stick. What we did was actually something different. It was Ray using a stick, so it was giving further information about the kind of hitting, it was modifying the hitting, so to speak, rather than modifying the man. And the difference is a structural difference. The difference is a structural difference in the sense that the tree looks different. So if we remove this or move it back to where we had it originally, then we have again the other situation where it was the instrument, the stick, that Ray used to hit the poor old man. So this is why I like trees, because it is very easy to show a structural difference and explain an ambiguity that perhaps otherwise would be more difficult to explain. Now the sentence that we have here is still one where we have two subjects. We have Ray and we have he. But of course in the sentence that I gave you as preparation for today, that was different. We have Ray regrets hitting the old man with a stick. So in other words, we only have the verb there, but who is doing the hitting isn't there. Now, of course, it is there somehow, notionally, but it's empty. It's like as if the slot wasn't filled. And that's what happens when we have a subordinate clause without a subject. Usually, the subject is retrievable. We know that we're talking about the same person, okay, but the actual slot is empty. Yeah. Notice that I said you could come up with a weird situation where Ray and he is not the same person. Yeah. Regret, I don't know, causing, it's very iffy. I think probably the default is really that Ray and the person hitting, namely he, is the same. You certainly can't do it if you remove it, if you come up with the version that you see on the screen here, then Ray must have been the person doing the hitting. Okay? So, those were the trees really, two different trees, but this was the tree that I wanted you to come up with. And I hope that's clarified a few things about subjects, clauses, and things like that. But there will be more. Okay. But before I do this, I'd like to quickly say a few words about ambiguity. I said the sentence is ambiguous. We could interpret it differently. Now, in real life, and this is an important statement, in real life, ambiguity hardly ever exists. Okay. You can come up with sentences that are ambiguous in isolation, but you will hardly be in a situation, in a context, where you as a communicative partner wonder, now did he or she mean X or Y? It's hardly ever the case. Sometimes you may need to think about it, but usually not even that. But when it occurs, or perhaps also simply as a phenomenon when we look at it in isolation, we can differentiate between different types of ambiguity. First of all, there could be lexical ambiguity. We're simply talking about two words meaning different things. Or we could have a structural ambiguity. This is what we saw just now, where the words meant exactly the same thing, but because the tree was different, we had a different meaning of the whole sentence. Okay. And it does matter whether it's, well, a man with an old stick or whether the old man is hit with a stick, of course. Okay. I'll just give you two or three others just to make that point. Enraged cow injures farmer with axe. Now, I think this underlines two points. First of all, in real life, this isn't really ambiguous. Okay? Can you imagine that the cow is wielding an axe and and injures the farmer. Of course not. Okay, so this is a contrived example. Okay. It's a headline also. Headlines in English are interesting because usually they are much more condensed and certain elements are left out that really should be there in a grammatically well-formed sentence if it's not a headline. Okay. What is this? A structural or is it a lexical ambiguity? Structural, yes, okay. Same words, but depending on who is holding the axe. Yeah, so it's the same thing. This is a nasty one. Survivor of Siamese twins joins parents. Okay. What's this? Structural or semantic? Or lexical? Yes? It's lexical, yeah. It's different meanings of what is expressed by joining. Is it a literal joining, or is it joining, let's say, leaving the hospital or something like that? Okay, yeah. All right? Again, this is a headline, okay? Eye drops off shelf. What does it mean? Well, it could mean that the eye drops off the shelf, yes, which is perhaps less likely. But it could also mean that a certain brand of eye drops are taken off the shelves because of various, I don't know, side effects or something like that. And this is a very condensed headline. Lexical or structural? It's lexical, but of course we are also talking about a completely different structure here. I mean, we're talking even about the different word class. Drop, as in the future, the plural of the noun drops versus the verb. So we also have a completely different structure. So we could, in a way, say it's both lexical and structural. Okay. Yeah. This one I'm not going to explain. I'll leave that up to you to find out what's ambiguous here and whether it's structural or not. When I came home, I saw two mice screwing in a light bulb. Okay? Those of you who don't get it, you need to look up screwing in a dictionary. In a good one. Okay. Good, let's move on. That was a bit on ambiguity. Yes, sorry about the sentence, but I thought this was a subtle way of pointing out something that I've said before, but anyway. I'd like to look a little bit more at different clause types. The student who had not done all the readings failed miserably. Okay. How many clauses? And how can you tell? Okay, so we have, or to phrase it in the way that I put it in terms of how do you count clauses, if you have two verbs, if you have two lexical verbs, in this case, do and fail, then you have two clauses. Yes, but your explanation was absolutely correct. We have two verbs, or rather we have two verb groups. We have elements that belong to the same verb, and we will be talking about those elements in a minute. And you're also correct in isolating who had not done all the readings as the subordinate clause. What kind of clause is it? I'm sure you know this. It's a relative clause. Okay. What does the relative clause do? Again, you've correctly phrased that. It gives additional information about the student. You can also say it modifies the noun student, syntactically speaking. It modifies it in just the same way as an adjective does, in a way. The lazy student who had not done all the readings failed miserably. Okay. So both lazy and the relative clause are not obligatory in the same sense. Okay. It's a different structure, but both of them modify the noun student. One of them pre-modifies it, and the other one post-modifies it. Now, what's the subject of the main clause? subject of the main course. Yes, you want to say it or what? No! I was so much hoping, yes. Thank you. Okay. You don't need to knock your head, it's fine. Yeah, but next time. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Do you understand why? Because, of course, I've just said it. The post-modification belongs to the student. It modifies the head noun of the noun phrase. And therefore, hierarchically, it belongs under the same node and therefore belongs to the subject. Okay? But it also means that we actually have a subclause within a noun phrase. Yeah? We have a subclause, namely the relative clause, who had not done all the readings, within a noun phrase. And this is something which I think we've seen before. So I said that, I mean, clauses are made up of phrases, yes, but we can also have phrases that contain clauses. Okay? So it can go both ways, but it is a different level of the rank scale that I introduced in lecture one. Okay, let's look at that sentence a little bit more, or rather let's compare it to this one here. Students who tend to get their degree before the age of 25 form an important part of this society. Okay? What's the difference? Well, the first one, as I'm sure you know from your school days, is about a specific student. Okay? It's about a specific student. Yeah. One that we have in mind, someone that has failed, and we know the reason why. Okay? The second one is about students in general. Usually students, the prototypical student, and if I look at you, then that pretty much, I mean, you pretty much conform in most cases to what I'm saying here. You are probably below 25, and many of you will have got your degree by the time you are 25. Okay. So this is about students, the kind of group of people who are students in general. Okay. If you have a counterexample, then that doesn't invalidate the claim, but we're saying something fairly generic here. Another example. Children who perform well at school have better chances of getting a well-paid job. Okay. Is this like the first one or is this like the second one? Who's in favor of the first one? Who's in favor of the second one? Okay, so you... Let's look at the second one then. Children who normally know how to tie their shoes at the age of 5 have major problems with English spelling. Did I say students? Not children, right? Okay. Yeah. Children who normally... Not really. I wasn't trying to make a nasty comment here. I really didn't know whether I said students or children. Children who normally know how to tie their shoes at the age of 5 have major problems with English spelling. Is this like the first one? Who's in favor of the first one? Okay. Who's in favor of the second one? Second one meaning, okay, fewer people put their hands up because they're a bit worried. Okay. Yeah. Right. Now, what does the first one down here do? Does it tell us something about the general, about children in general? Well, no, it tells us something about a restricted subset of all children. So, like the student who had not done all the readings and therefore failed miserably, we are reducing the potential group of all students to one, okay, in that case, and here we reduce the potential group of all children to those that perform well in school. So we're restricting the list of reference that this sentence refers to. In the second one, it's different. Okay. Children in general usually, normally, know how to tie their shoes at the age of 5. Okay. So this is a restrictive relative clause in the first case and a non-restrictive relative clause in the second one. And this one up here is also the first one a restrictive, and the second one a non-restrictive relative clause. Notice that here I had a distinction also in terms of punctuation. A lot of people learn the difference about restrictive and non-restrictive, or in fact about defining and non-defining relative clauses in terms of whether there is a comma or not. Now, yes, this could be a good indication, but unfortunately comma rules are fairly flexible, or at least not very, you'll find a lot of people using comma rules very inconsistently in English. So I would not look at the comma, I would look at what the relative clause does, whether it restricts the group of reference to one or a subgroup, or whether it says something general about the whole set of reference. Okay? This is the book I lost last year, and it's just been returned to me. What's different here from the sentences that I've just shown you? Well, one difference is that there is no that or which, okay, or who. There is no pronoun, there is no relative pronoun. Is it not there? Well, is it just simply not there? Well, it's in a way deleted. Okay. The slot for it is there, but it has been deleted. It's the same as this is the book that I lost last year, or which I lost last year. This kind of deletion is very, very common in spoken language. It is much less common in written language, and particularly in very formal contexts like legal language, etc. But it is the same. It is also a relative clause. Yes?
Is that called omitting?
It's called omitting, yes. Yeah. You omit the relative clause. Yeah. You delete it, you omit it. Yes. The omission of the relative, relative pronoun. Yes. In fact, you can omit even more. Okay. Have a look at this. The man seen on this picture is a famous artist. What's omitted here? What's deleted here? Or even this one. No, not even. Another example. Half of the tickets available to Liverpool fans were sold abroad. Okay. What is deleted here? Well, not just the relative pronoun, who or that. That's not the only thing that's omitted. But what's actually omitted is the relative pronoun plus the form of the verb be that's needed. Okay? So the man who is seen on the picture is a famous artist. Okay? So that's a sort of a form of greater reduction here in the syntactic structure. But again, I would say it's still a relative clause. Okay. You don't need to know this, but this is what people call whiz deletion. W-H-I-S, or I-Z, sorry. But this is a term which I didn't even want to put on the slides, because it's certainly not anything that I would expect you to know. There is no that, which, or who, and no be. Okay, that's as much as I wanted to say about clauses and about elements in the clauses for the moment, and I'd now like to look at verb phrases in a little bit more detail, and in particular also verb groups and the kind of verbs that can be used there. What do we already know? We know that verb phrases must contain a verb, okay, because that's the head of the verb phrase. We also know that there are different types of verbs in the sense of what they require as participants to make the whole scene complete on stage, if you think of it as a stage. Okay. So we have verbs that require one object, we have a verb like stumble that doesn't require any object at all, just someone who stumbles. And we have a verb like give, which requires, in fact, two objects. We also know, this is very basic, that verbs can have different forms. Hit, hits, hitting, and all these forms are word forms of the same lexeme, sometimes called lemma. Okay. We also know that there are lexical verbs, or full verbs, and modal verbs, or auxiliaries. Let's have a quick look at what verb groups are possible. He interviews many people. He has interviewed many people. He was interviewed by Larry King. He might have interviewed many people. He was being interviewed. He should have been interviewed. He should be being interviewed right now, but he isn't. He might have been being interviewed then, but I don't know. Okay? I suggest that he be interviewed now. Okay? It's a very formal use. I'll come to that at the end of the lecture. So there are quite a lot of different forms that the verb group can take, and they all, the different forms have to do with, well, different aspects of meaning that's conveyed, grammatical meaning. For example, when does the action take place? Is it now or is it in the past? But not only that, is it also with respect to yet another action that we know of, before or after or at the same time? Is this an action that's finished or not? Am I, as a speaker, sure about the action? Might have been being interviewed. No, I'm not in that case. Okay. So all of these are elements which are actually encoded from a grammatical point of view in the verb group. Okay. So the form of the verb, or more precisely the verb group, changes depending on the answer to those questions. Okay. I'd like to look at these aspects a little bit more in more detail. And in fact, what I'm going to do here, I'm going to look at the following four concepts: tense, aspect, mood, and voice. Okay, these are the technical terms for this. Many of those things will be obvious to you, I think, but maybe not as part of those linguistic terms: tense, aspect, mood, and voice. Okay. Let's have a quick look at what types of verb there are, what types of verbs. Just to repeat again, there are lexical verbs: go, come, stay, very frequent ones, think, but of course, well, extrapolate, just as an example of an infrequent one. These are full lexical verbs. If you see one of those, you know there is a clause. There are auxiliary verbs, helping verbs, okay? Hilfs, right? Okay. Will, would, could, can, might, may, should, must, and a few others. And then there are the primary auxiliaries, which can also function as full lexical verbs: be, have, and do. So far, so good. This is repetition, I think. Let's look at tense. That's the first of the four categories that I just mentioned. I like chocolate. He likes chocolate. Okay. He eats chocolate. Three sentences that have something in common, apart from the word chocolate. Okay. I stumbled last night, he stumbled last night, he ate chocolate. Okay. This is very primitive. Yeah, okay, they're not the best, anyway. But what the point that I want to make is, and that's very simple, first set of three sentences is in the present tense, the second is in the past tense. Fine, no problem whatsoever. I will meet her tonight. I'm playing football tonight. Probably should have put there, I will be eating chocolate tonight. What is this? Future tense, I heard. No. 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 Okay. There is no future tense. Okay. Why is there no future tense? Okay. There is no future tense because if you look at, and I've colored it here for you, if you look at how the future, yes, I agree with you, all of these sentences, the two down there, I will meet her tonight, etc., are about events that take place in the future. In that sense, this is correct. But the fact is not because, or this is not the case, because there is a morphological element, an inflectional morpheme, which is attached to the verb and thereby expresses the future. This is the case in other languages, okay, but not in English. And in fact, even something like this, my plane leaves at 5 p.m. You can say this at, I don't know, 7 a.m. in the morning. It's about something that's happening in the future, but it is in the present tense too. Okay. So we only have two tenses in English, and all the other elements, all the other aspects about when something happens, also with respect to other happenings, etc., are all elements that are not aspects of tense, but something else. And I'll be going into the something else in a minute. So please, next time when someone asks you how many tenses does English have, say two. Okay. Good. Now, one distinction that I think has already come up is this distinction between finite and non-finite clauses. Okay. Let's have a look at this in a little bit more detail. We have those two sentences, one present tense, one past tense. He goes to London, he went to London. You cannot say, unless you're a speaker of non-standard English, he gone to London, he going to London, or he to go to London, or he go to London. All of those are not considered standard English, or part of standard English. So only the top two sentences work. Okay. On the other hand, you can say something like this. He went to London, catching a train at noon. You can also say, to catch the train, he walked to the station. And you can say something like, having gone to London, he returned home. So we have those verbs that didn't work in the sentence above, and it works fine, or these forms. Why? Because this is fine if the verbs are in the subordinate clause. Ray regrets hitting, okay? We had a subordinate clause, we had the verb of the subordinate clause in the ing form. This is possible because it is a subordinate clause, but you could not say Ray hitting the man. Okay? Only if it is part of a subclause. Now, what can we say in connection with these sentences and tense? Okay. I already gave you the tense of the top two sentences, past tense and present tense. Well, the first one present, the second one past. What tense is catching in, or to catch, or having gone? Is this present, or is it past? Or is it perhaps something else? Let's look at this. He went to London catching a train at noon. Is this about something that's happening in the past? Yes. Okay. But that's because of the verb went. He will go to London catching a train at noon. Something about something that's happening in the future, expressed with the present tense form here. Okay. He goes to London catching a train at noon. He had gone to London catching a train at noon. Now, in all cases, we are talking about a different time when this happens, perhaps with relation to another event. But the point I would like to make is that catching a train at noon in isolation does not express a specific time. It requires the main clause in order for us to understand when it happens. So this is about the relationship between the main and the subordinate clause, where the temporal aspect becomes obvious. This is because the linguist says that catching does not carry tense. Okay? There is no element of tense, either past or present, on the verb catching here, but it is only in conjunction with the main clause that we can know when something is happening. That's why we call it a non-finite verb. Okay. That's why verbs that are used in clauses, in the subordinate clauses, like to go to the cinema or something like that, form non-finite subordinate clauses. He went to London, okay, heard this before. He has gone to London, he will have gone to London, he might have been going to London for a while. Okay. Different verb groups, and I've always colored the first one in red. Why? Because they're all main clauses, okay. So they carry tense, Well, the verb group carries tense. But what exactly is it in the verb phrase that carries tense? If a verb group is finite, that is, we know about tense information on the basis of what we see in terms of form, it will be the first element that carries tense. This is a minor point that I just wanted to make. You will also see that there is a modal verb here, might have been going. A few points about modal verbs now, and also then in connection with tense. They only function as auxiliary verbs. They don't take any inflections. You can't say he mights or something like that. It's always the same form. Modals are quite interesting because they express a whole range of meanings. Some of the modals actually have different meanings depending on context. For example, permission, you may leave now. Obligation, you must hand in your assignment before the deadline. Or something that's known, volition. And again, I don't expect you to know the term volition, but I just wanted to make the point that modals can have various types of meanings. Volition is another word, it's a fancy term for intention. Okay. Shall, be going to, I shall help him tonight, you know, sort of old-fashioned way of putting it. I'll give you a few examples of those meanings. He's driving a Rolls-Royce. He must be rich. Mm-hmm. We read into the fact that he drives a Rolls-Royce that he is probably rich. Mm-hmm. This is different from must, as in you must hand in your assignment at 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean about modal verbs having different functions, different meanings. You should have started work on this earlier. Or this might be the best thing to do now. Okay. In the case of the second one, you should, it's a case of obligation. Okay. And this might be is not a question of obligation. You must go now is a case of obligation again. Okay, I'll come back to modals in a minute. Tense and finiteness. He catches a train to London. He catching a train to London. Okay. The verb in the independent clause is finite. Okay. And the verb in the dependent clause can be finite. I know that he likes chocolate, but it doesn't have to be. I hate to see you cry. Yes. Same situation as before. What we have here is basically the subject that's omitted or deleted because of the non-finite clause. I hate, I see you cry. Some of the verb groups that you've seen contain modals. He must be catching a train to London right now. Okay. And this is just to finalize my point on modals and finiteness. If there is a modal, then the modal is the finite verb in the verb group. There can also be only one word in the verb group, which is the one that carries tense. So, a finite verb is a verb that is morphologically marked for tense, or a modal verb. Good, that was tense, and I hope you can now handle aspect. Okay. It's related to tense in some way, or it interacts with tense. A number of sentences again to start with. John crosses the street. John is crossing the street. No doubt, present tense. Both. Both of them are present tense. John crossed the street. John was crossing the street when a car swerved around the corner at high speed. Okay? Past tense. Now, the way to visualize this, or one way to visualize this, is to have a time sort of scale here or a line which indicates time from the past to the future, and we are here at the now, and the now is the speech event. Okay. Now, which of those four sentences is this one? One, two, three, or four? The third one, yeah? Because sometime in the past, John crossed the street. So this is how we can visualize this with respect to the speech event. Okay. So this is what we call the simple aspect. I'll come back to that in a minute. What happens if we want to visualize the sentence just below this? John was crossing the street when a car swerved. Mm-hmm. Well, we now have an action that's taking place. This is expressed with the ing form, okay, the progressive, was crossing. And then suddenly, like, well, as we had before, a single event happens. Now this red element here, which is expressed with the ing form, is called, or is in the, is a verb in the progressive aspect. So we have simple aspect, we have progressive aspect. And we have also got perfect aspect. Britain has become one of the first nations to adopt the new approach. Is this present or past tense? Who's in favor of present tense? Okay. Who's in favor of past tense? Okay. Present tense is correct. Okay. Why is it present tense? Well, look at the form of the verb that carries tense. The first verb in the verb group carries tense. This is a present tense form. Otherwise, it would have been had become. Okay. Let's visualize this. Okay. There is a time when Britain becomes this, well, when it happens, okay? But, and the past event in that sense is completed, but it is relevant now. So, in a way, this is not something that's actually happening in the same sense as was crossing, but it is an event which happened in the past, but which has relevance now. If we slightly change the sentence to Britain had become one of the first nations to adopt the new approach when Churchill decided to do something, then the whole move is moved backwards in time. We are now talking about something which lies completely in the past, which is no longer relevant for the present speech event, but it is something that was relevant up to a certain time in the past, which is then indicated with the past tense verb decided. Okay? So, we have four different options. I am laughing, I have laughed, I laugh, and I have been laughing. One is the progressive, one is the perfect, one is neither, or what I call the simple aspect, and one is in fact both. Or we can visualize this here with, in this table, we have tense on the one hand, on the one side, and then progressive or perfect on the other, on the top, and you can see how there are four different options. Now, I'd like you to compare this to the myth that English has no grammar. Okay. Quite obviously, there is quite a bit of grammar, but it's expressed differently from what the layperson considers to be grammar. Okay, that was tense and aspect. Voice. What's voice? Well, the student read the book, therefore he or she didn't fail. Okay. Active voice. Okay. The student is the person actually doing this. Okay. The book was read by the student. What is it? Passive. Okay. That's actually what voice is all about, whether it's active or passive. I don't really need to revise how we create the passive, I think. The object becomes subject of a new sentence, and the subject becomes part of is integrated into a preposition phrase. Okay. Not necessarily. Sometimes we can omit the subject in the preposition phrase, or we can omit the action of moving it into a preposition phrase. The book was banned, and then the agent who is behind the banning is left unsaid, unmentioned. And this is a strategy that's often used in texts to sort of remove agency of some sort, in some way or other. My car was stolen last week. Sometimes it is removed because we simply don't know who did the stealing. Okay. That's how it can be quite simply expressed. So the preposition phrase is optional. Some people call this distinction between whether the preposition phrase is there or not a distinction between a long passive and a short passive, just in case you find this in the literature. What's this? The book reads well. Passive or active? Who's in favor of active? Okay, a few. Who's in favor of passive? Okay. More people are in favor of passive. Let's show you another one. The auditorium seats 1,000. Well, this one I think seats 300. Okay. Now, in a way, both of you are right. It's an active structure, but we have a passive meaning. This is a really, it's a bit of an odd construction. Some people call it the middle construction because it's in the middle between active and passive, so to speak. Okay. Some people call it the medial passive. Sounds a bit more fancy. Okay. Again, this can be used for stylistic reasons. The participant is presented as central and controlling the situation, but it's not the actual agent. The book is not the agent, but it's still central to what we want to say. Okay, I've gone on for almost an hour, but I'd like you just to get two minutes of a breather now before I finish off. This is a very simple, I think, exercise, but it'll give you 1 or 2 minutes to breathe, just sort of to make sure we all know what a passive is. Can you please spot the passives here? And I'll be quiet for a minute or one and a half. Okay, well, that was just over a minute, but I think you don't need more than that. And since you didn't start chatting too much, I think you're quite happy if I continue. I wonder whether you got all of those. Are required. And of course, not only are required, but also to be prepared. Okay, so there are two passive forms following each other in two clauses. Okay. And are required to be taken. Is satisfied, is specified, and have been prepared or adopted. Well, basically, have been prepared or have been adopted. So this is coordinated. Right. This is very typical of the kind of legal language that we have here. And one of the reasons why I wanted to show this to you is because next week in the Christmas lecture, which I will be uploading together with this one, which is the lecture from last year, as I said at the beginning of the lecture course, I will be looking at text types or differences between, let's say, spoken and written language and other text types with respect to different syntactic structures or perhaps, in this case, verb groups. So we had tense, aspect, and voice, and we can now mix and match those. Okay. We can have active present in the progressive and in the perfect aspect. Okay. She is training versus she has trained. We can put this into the past and say she was training the dog or she had trained the dog. Okay. Where the difference is between those two past tense sentences, whether it's the progressive aspect or the perfect aspect. And of course the whole thing can then be done not in only in the active voice, but also in the passive voice. The dog is being trained versus was being trained, has been trained, had been trained. And I could have made an even more complex table by including more options. So just to make that point again about having no grammar. One last thing. If you can still bear with me up there in the corner. No, they don't notice. Yes, now they have. Okay. All right. Yes, I know it's Christmas soon, but still. Okay. Mood. This is really, well, partly about how true, or it's got to do something about with the speaker's attitudes. This can be expressed by modal verbs, but it's also mood as marked on the verb. And in that sense, it's a quality, a formal feature of the verb group. This has absolutely nothing, and this is a danger that sometimes when people talk about mood, then they talk about the mood of a text. Okay, this has nothing to do with literary mood or anything. So a somber mood in a particular piece of literature. This is not. But basically, this is about indicative, subjunctive and imperative mood. Okay. The indicative expressing factual events, subjunctive hypothetical events, and the imperative is a directive. So this is a minor category in the sense that it's not, I mean, you should know something about tense and aspect. Mood is perhaps less important, I would say. Subjunctive. Just to say a few words on the subjunctive, it's actually quite a rare phenomenon in English. It is much more common in other languages. I think French, for example. But what actually happens in the subjunctive? In the present tense subjunctive, we basically use the base form of the verb in sentences like this. I insist that he finish immediately. Okay. The first time I remember when I was when I learned English a long time ago, I saw such a sentence, I thought, this is a mistake. The author has simply forgotten something. Okay? I insist that he finishes immediately, I thought. Okay? But no, this is the subjunctive form. And it expresses, well, it happens after verbs like insist, suggest, demand, etc. These are verbs expressing volition. This is the term that I used before in the context of modality. An alternative way here is found in the sentence, be he alive or be he dead, whether he is alive or whether he is dead, no matter, we want him, we want to find him. Okay. Or in a very old-fashioned use of the present tense subjunctive, God save the Queen. You may have wondered before, why isn't it God saves the Queen? No, it's may God save the Queen. Okay, or should do this. Okay, so this is the form of the present tense subjunctive. Now the past tense subjunctive is only possible with a form of the verb to be, namely were. If I were you. Nowadays people say, if I was you, and unless you're a prescriptive linguist, you will accept this in virtually all circumstances. Okay. I haven't checked this with our Sprachpraxis people, but I don't know what they teach you, but that's, I think, the reality, at least in the place where I lived in Britain. If I were a rich man. Okay. So it's a hypothetical situation. Okay. Were it to turn out in that way, etc., or that something has happened. So this is the past subjunctive. The subjunctive, I think, well, no, as I said, is a fairly infrequent one. Something that is slightly more frequent is the imperative. Okay. I was going to ask you to spot the imperatives, but I think we can all do this very quickly. This is a recipe, and in the recipe, recipe is probably the text type with the most imperatives that can be found. Very typical here, peel, set, heat the oil, add the spring onions, etc. Okay. Good, we are not quite there yet, but we're reaching the end of the lecture. It's not over yet, so don't start packing up. Okay? But I wanted to make a few general points by way of summary before I mention something which is a little bit more advanced and which is only for those people who haven't switched off yet. Okay? Which I hope is all of you, but still, who want to know more. Okay? Just some major, not findings, but some points I really would like you to take home from this lecture and from the whole series of lectures on syntax. Very importantly, English has only two tenses. Okay? Made that point at the beginning of the lecture. There is no future tense. Yes, we can express the future, but we do it differently. We do not do it with morphological marking on the verb. We have some verb groups that are finite, i.e. they carry tense. Okay? There is something morphological in the first element of the verb group that marks it as being a finite verb, while others are non-finite. Okay? I've already said that the first element is the one where in the verb group where the tense element is found. Okay? And then we have aspect, voice, and mood, which are features that can change from one verb phrase to the next. It is not a good idea to talk about the voice or the mood of a text. Okay, that's a point that I make. Okay. You can talk about the mood of a text, but then you're not talking about grammar. Okay. Subjunctives are very rare in English. Okay, this is maybe not such a major point, but I wanted to summarize the lecture. And this is really important. All those elements are formal aspects of verbs. Okay. So a progressive is only a progressive if the verb has the relevant form, in this case, an ing participle. If the verb expresses something which you know could be a longer, could take a longer period of time, that doesn't mean it's a progressive. The progressive is the form of the verb in which it is. It is dependent on the form of the verb. Okay, that was the summary of the lecture, and I would like to finish with a few slides on something slightly more advanced. Those of you, there is something going to be at the end as well, so don't leave yet, but those of you who would like to know a little bit more, have a look at this. Here is a simple sentence. He gave the man an apple. We have the verb to give, and I already said that give is a verb that requires two objects. He wants an answer this second. What do we have? We have the verb want. Is it also a verb that requires two objects? No. I want chocolate. Okay. I don't really like chocolate that much, but anyway. I want chocolate. No. Anyway, he wants an answer this second. Okay. Yes, yes. What kind of verb is want? It is a transitive verb, okay? So what is this second then? What is this second? It's an element that's optional. It's an adjunct. Okay. Now, if we were to draw trees, what would the trees look like of those two sentences? Okay. He gave the man an apple. Let's do this one first, and I'll do this quite quickly. We have the word class level first. Then he, the subject, noun phrase, and then the verb phrase, gave the man an apple. There are two noun phrases in the verb phrase, which function as complements to the verb want, and this is what the final tree looks like. So we have two elements here, and we have the verb, which is the head of the verb phrase here. Does the tree look differently in any way for the other sentence? He wants an answer this second. No. Not really. Okay. All I've done here is I replaced once, or replaced give with once. Okay. Well, I also replaced the other words, but it's the same tree. Okay. Yeah. Now, what is this? Is it a complement or an adjunct? We've said before, in the case of give, which is a ditransitive verb, both elements are required. In the case of want, this is not the case. This cannot be seen in the tree. In a good theory, no, not in a good theory, but in a good way of tree drawing, we would like to show this. Now, as I said, I don't expect you to draw trees actively. I expect you to understand them. I also expect you to understand them in the sense that if I give you a tree in, let's say, an exam or something like that, you should be able to put correct words underneath each node to make the tree reflect the sentence underneath. Okay? So you should have an understanding of how it works, okay? But you should not think that you have to draw them actively yourself. The best way to find out how it works is, of course, to draw them yourself. So, anyway, yeah. But I'm not saying that. I mean, I'm not. This would take simply too much time to teach you how to do full trees here. Okay. Now, this is a slight problem. Well, a problem if you are concerned with these kind of things. That the tree looks exactly the same, but we have a different verb. One verb which requires both an object, well, both an indirect and a direct object. And we have no way to show that this is only an adjunct which we could leave out. There is a way to do this, and I want to show this just for those people who are interested. In these trees you really don't even have to know actively. Okay? We can introduce an additional level, something like a V something, V bar actually it's called. This is called V bar because when it was found in the, when it was established in the 70s, computers couldn't put bars on top of it. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Now this looks different. This looks different in the sense that want and an answer are now on a different hierarchical level. This second is attached somewhere else. In the same way as with the stick, or with a stick before, was attached somewhere else, but this is slightly different. Okay. Let's look at the other sentence. He gave the man an apple. This still looks like, well, what we had before. There is no additional level here. Okay. And what we see is that the two elements which are required are on the same hierarchical level as the verb, give. Okay. So both noun phrases are sisters of the verb. Both are complements. If we have a quick look at the other one again, then only the answer, an answer is a sister of the verb, and the second, which is the adjunct, is no longer a sister of the head, but is higher up in the tree hierarchy. So, an answer is a complement, and the second is an adjunct. Okay. Now, this is a way to indicate with the tree that the verb, in this case, is only a transitive verb and not a ditransitive verb. In fact, even in a noun phrase like a happy man, we could indicate that the adjective phrase is optional by adding this additional level of the N bar, which shows that happy is not on the same level as the noun phrase. In fact, and this is the final slide in this connection, the theory is that all phrases look alike, that whether it's a noun phrase or a verb phrase, or whatever, X stands for anyone, they all have the same structure internally where the adjunct is not on the same level as the complement. Okay. Now, as I said, you can forget about this again, in a way, but I wanted to show you that there is much more there, and if you're interested in syntax, then you can draw lots of trees to be much more detailed about, it's a more detailed representation of the structure of language. Good, that almost ends the lecture. I was already last year looking for an option of for a nice option of ending the lecture just before Christmas, even though this time it's actually a whole week before Christmas, and I just couldn't find anything that was that had to do with linguistics and Christmas. But I thought I'd still like you. Yeah, Christmas doesn't seem to be a very linguistic-y thing, but anyway, I thought I would like to end on something lighter anyway that has to do with language at least, and I would like to play you a short clip. Maybe you know the people, this is fairly old, but it actually mentions quite a few things that are relevant to what we're doing here in the course. It's also fairly quick. Therefore, I'm going to upload it to StudIP as a separate clip, or actually, I'm probably just going to give you the link to the YouTube address where you can find it. But here is Stephen Fry and colleague.
So let's talk instead about flexibility of language, linguistic elasticity of language.
Yes, I think I said earlier that our language, English,
as spoken by us,
as we speak, yes, certainly defines it. We are defined by our language, if you will.
Hello, we're talking about language.
Perhaps I can illustrate my point. Let me at least try. Here's a question. my question is this. Is our language, English, capable? Is English capable of sustaining demagoguery?
Demagoguery?
Demagoguery.
And by demagoguery you mean?
By demagoguery I mean demagoguery.
I also.
highly charged oratory, persuasive whipping up rhetoric. Listen to me. If we had been British, would we, under similar circumstances, have been moved, charged up, fired up by these inflammatory speeches, or would we simply have laughed? Is English too ironic to sustain Hitlerian styles? Would his language simply run false in our ears?
We're talking about things we need false in our ears.
May I compartmentalise? I hate you, but may I? Is our language a function of our British cynicism, tolerance, resistance to false emotion, humour, and so on? Or do those qualities come extrinsically from the language itself? It's a chicken and egg problem.
We're talking about chickens, we're talking about eggs.
Let me start deliberate here. There's language, and there's speech. There's chess, and there's a game of chess. Mark difference for me, mark it please.
We've moved on to chess.
Imagine a piano keyboard, 88 keys, only 88, and yet hundreds of new melodies, new tunes, new harmonies are being composed from hundreds of different keyboards every day in Dorset and Lebanon. Our language, hundreds of thousands of available words, trillions of legitimate new ideas, so that I can say the following sentence and be utterly sure that nobody has ever said it before in the history of human communication. Hold the newsreader's nose squarely, waiter, or friendly milk will come to mark my trousers. That's an ordinary word, but never before put in that precise order. A unique child delivered to a unique mother. We all of us spend all our days saying to each other the same things time after weary time. I love you, don't go in there, get out, you have no right to say that, stop it, why should I, that hurt, help, Marjorie is dead. But surely it's a thought to make up for a cream tea on a rainy Sunday afternoon.
So humanity is more than just means of communication.
Oh, of course it is. My brother, my sister, my whore, my mistress, my checkout girl, language is a complimentary, moist, lemon-scented, cleansing, swearing, fresh apple. Language is the breath of God. Language is the dew on a fresh apple. It's the soft rain of dust that falls into a shaft of morning light as you pluck from an old bookshelf a half-forgotten book of erotic memoirs. Language is the creak on the stair. It's a spluttering match held to a frosted pane. It's a heart-remembered childhood birthday party. It's the warm, wet, trusting touch of a leaking napkin. The hulk of a child panzer. The underside of a granite boulder. The first downy growth on the upper lip of the Mediterranean. Its cobwebs long since overrun by an old Wellington boot.
Okay. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.